My Sit Back Sunday guest today is family psychotherapist and clinical director of the Therapy Institute, Richard Hogan. He is the best-selling author of the book Parenting the Screenager, and he also writes for the Irish Examiner every week, exploring mental health issues of teenagers, couples and families. But today I wanted to talk to him about why our mid to late 40s are known as the unhappy years and what we can do to avoid the pitfalls. And we also talk about the pursuit of happiness in general and why, like most things, you gotta put the work in if you want to succeed. Enjoy. Richard, lovely to e-meet you, as they say. It's the way we're still meeting people these days. How are you keeping?
Absolutely lovely to meet you, Catherine. I'm doing very well, thanks very much. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, me too. And I suppose, you know, we have done in our online community, we have done a lot of talk about happiness. One of our team is, she calls herself the Minister for Happiness, Aislinn Cambridge. She's from Cork. So she's kind of studied in this area a lot. So I've learned a lot from her and it's been a focus. And she is literally one of these people that every Wednesday she comes on to our community and she is the epitome of happiness. Like, she lives and breathes what she promotes, I suppose, or what she believes in. And I suppose, in a way, this year, none of us have traveled. None of us have been able to possibly journey where we want to journey. But one journey that we've all been on, or that we all want to go on, is this pursuit of happiness. And it's so individual. And I just, you know, and I'd love to get your thoughts on the fact that there's not one journey to, like, there's not this one journey to happiness that's kind of perfect for everybody.
No, absolutely. And I think in the age that we live in, with, you know, 6-minute abs and everything is abbreviated and everything's multifaceted and everything is now, there's the immediacy for everything. It has to be now, you know, the way communication is so instantaneous. I think people think that happiness is something that they should have immediately. When I want it, it should be here. And actually being happy is putting a few things in place and being intentional about it and having a good outlook in life. And often at times, actually, to really be happy, you have to delay gratification in the moment to put into place things that will, later on will come into life, will actually make you happy and make you content in your life. So it does take a bit of work. And for people that can, I think what I meet in my clinic is people often come in, Catherine, and they're talking about this idea of, like, why aren't I happy? And the first question I ask them is, you know, well, what does happiness look like for you? And there's a real pregnant pause, you know, because as you said there in your introduction, it's such a bespoke, it's such an individual thing. It's such a unique thing for all of us. You know, someone like listening to death metal, to me, that would be a very unhappy moment in my life. And so, you know, we all have different desires and different things that really appeal to us and different things that are in place in our life that will make us happy. And often I ask that question, what does happiness look like for you? It can be a real pause because they don't know what they're searching for. They just have this idea of happiness.
Yeah. But I suppose when we're kids, like, I'm trying to think personally, right? I would say that I'm somebody who has quite a happy disposition. My dad, for example, right? My dad is just one of these guys. He has been through the shits and back again with business. He has been in receivership twice. He was in he's got a steel company. But he is one of the people, and one of the very few people that I've met in my life, that nothing ever really seems to get him down. Now, he has bad days, but he has this just incredible way of dealing with anxiety, dealing with stress, dealing with problems, and actually being able to somehow, you know, compartmentalize it in his head and not let it affect him. Whereas I think I'm generally a happy person. But Jesus, do I have my days? Do I have my weeks? Do I have my moments? For sure. But my dad is just one of these people. And maybe it's just he's really well, at, really, really good at hiding it. But he honestly, we've had conversations down through the years, the older we've got and, you know, the more stressed I've got as parents. And I've said to him, you know, how come nothing really bothers you? And he was like, I don't know. I just don't let it. You know what I mean? So my question, I suppose, is, do you believe that there are people who have happy dispositions and don't have to work as hard as others?
Well, I think definitely what people have is an ability to reframe things. I think what your dad does there is he reframes it. Okay. And I think people also develop this really destructive way of looking at things, and they develop really negative thoughts very early on. And we have these parts. It's incredible, Catherine. The human brain is just incredible. We have about 60,000 thoughts a day. And the majority of those are just unknown to us. They're in our subconscious and they're flying around, right? And when we're young, say between 0 and 7, we're really taking in, you know, that's the formation of who we are. We're taking in these ideas about ourselves. We're telling our story. We're telling ourselves a story about who we are. And, you know, one neuron fires to another neuron, and that creates a kind of a connection that becomes a pathway and a thought. So when that thought creates, you know, let's say I'm not good enough, or I'm not that pretty, or people don't really like me, but, you know, I don't like my body. And when we get those negative things, or I'm lazy, I'm not so academic, all the things that kind of, you know, get in there from school and from our peer group, and maybe unfortunately from the family that we're in, they create really negative paradigms. And so what can happen often is that we can often tend to worry, because we believe that worry itself will actually ameliorate whatever it is that we're worrying about. So people become worriers. You know, I hear parents saying to me a lot, she's just a worrier, she was always that way. And I don't think any of us are born thinking, you know, I'm not that pretty, or I'm not that friendly, or people don't think I'm lazy. None of us are born like that. We create those narratives about ourselves from what we feed on when we're very early on in that formation, that 0 to 7, where when our personality and who we think about who we are is forming. So for your dad, I would say he's got an incredible thing that sounds like you have, and I have also, is that you have an ability to reframe things and look at things as transient. That's when you look at someone who's resilient and has optimism in their life, they can see that, oh yeah, of course adversity is going to come into your life. Of course challenges are going to come your way. That's just the nature of being a human being. But your ability to see it as transient makes the difference between being optimistic and being a very negative person. And we can often develop very paradoxical ideas. I see this so much in my clinic, Catherine. It's just incredible. People would say to me that, you know, I'm just constantly down, you know, I'm just really down all the time. I can't find happiness. And when I go in there and I really start to unpack it, they've developed a belief that if you're unhappy, you can't fall. If you're up there and you're happy, you can get cut out, you're vulnerable, you can fall down into unhappiness. And that's very striking for their psyche. So they're saying, if I stay unhappy, at least I can't fall down.
Okay.
You know, and I said to them, well, you know, you're in a paradoxical solution there, because the paradox is you don't want to fall down into unhappiness, but your brain has come up with a solution to stay in the unhappiness. You can't fall down into it. So you're always in it. And there's the paradoxical intervention that you've come up for yourself. So to avoid the falling, you stay in the unhappiness. To avoid being unhappy, you're staying unhappy. Then there's the part, and it's like a light bulb moment, and they go, oh my God almighty, I never realized I was bringing this into my life. And I'm like, yeah, so what would it look like to be positive? And they're like, I can't even imagine what that would look like. What would it be like to see that, you know, adversity is transient? What would it be like to look at and see that you're actually resilient, and that you actually have loads of competencies? What would that be like to feel like that you can manage adversity? Of course it's going to come. Of course, it's going to knock you, and you're going to, you know, like all of us, me included, you have moments where you're kind of going, God, this is hard, and I feel this and I feel that. And you have those moments. That's just part of being human. But the ability to come out of those moments, and the ability to see that moment as transient. The happy moments are transient and the sad moments are transient. And I think what your dad has there is that ability to see the transience of stuff, to see that it's ephemeral, it's short lasting, it's not always with us. And that gives you way more optimism, because you know it's going to pass. You know, somebody who lacks resilience and is negative will say, you know, this is always going to be the way it is. You know, I'll always be like this. I'll never be able to be. That's just who I am. They're very concrete descriptions of themselves. And they're really like prisons. You're stuck in them. And it's like freeing yourself of those paradigms that can really bring a lot of joy into your life.
Like, and that makes so much sense. And I can see why people, it's almost like a fear to go in there when you say something like that. And it's almost like it's that, like, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway. It's like stepping outside of your comfort zone. Like, I would often have conversations with my parents as well. Like, I had a lovely childhood. We were very, you know, it was a great childhood. We were outdoors a lot. We were, it was a happy childhood. My dad had one as well. I'm hoping Ellie has one. And just even listen to you talking about those, the way our brain triggers from 0 to 7. And you get such an understanding then, even thinking in that space of kids who have a very difficult upbringing and how then that impacts on, you know, that environmental situation impacts on them all the way through life. And I'd say you see that in your clinic all the time.
all the time, Catherine. And like when I grew up, my father was a journalist for the Irish Times, so everything looked fab. I mean, you know, he was the Irish Times correspondent for the, you know, for Munster, and so it all looked great. But that was the veneer. We were actually all, you know, two other brothers. We were living with, you know, a father who was an addict. He was addicted to alcohol, and it was a very destructive environment to grow up in because it was so uncertain all the time. And you develop ideas about yourself, and it's now kind of something that gives me an awful lot of power, because when I'm dealing with teenagers, I can really see them coming in and, you know, guarded and protecting themselves and protecting the family. So it gives me great insight. So now it's a real tool for me. But as a kid growing up, it was a very difficult thing to experience, and it changes how you talk to yourself. And when you're young and you're living in a difficult family situation, because your family, the ecology of your family, Catherine, it's just the most important thing that you're ever going to, you know, go through. And it's the most complicated thing. And it can be, as you said yourself, you know, so beautiful, and can be so nurturing and you know, turning you into the person you are, or it can have very negative impact on you and make you think very negative things about yourself. And I see it in my clinic, you know, adults, you know, even managing partners of big firms, you know, and these really negative paradigms that they develop about themselves very young because of the families that they came out of, because of the ecologies that they've had to navigate that were so destructive and dysfunctional. And often I'd meet men, to be honest, in my clinic who'd say things to me like, you know, I don't know why I went into that affair. I didn't want to cheat my wife. I never had that idea that that's something that I wanted to do. And when we start unpacking and looking at it all, you can see all the destruction that they lived with through their childhood and what they did because they didn't talk to somebody like myself and they didn't get some insights into their behavior. They went out and they just replicated all that dysfunctionality that they'd seen in their lives. And, you know, I do a lot of work with addiction as well. And children who come out of addiction find it very hard to sit in a space that's quiet, because they're so not used to it. They're used to the familiar chaos, and they find it themselves very difficult. And it's something that I suppose, as I went on in my life, it was something that I really decided early on, I'm not going to carry this forward. That's not the parent I'm going to be. I'm not going to be drinking. I'm not going to be involved in anything that's going to be negative or having that, you know, that kind of stuff for my children. And I just made that conscious decision. Thankfully, I had it in me to do it. A lot of people don't, and they don't even know that they actually are replicating those behaviors.
When did you have those feelings? Like, what age were you?
Yeah, I was like, it's funny, I suppose I was around my early 20s.
Okay.
Around my early 20s, my teenagers, I was a difficult enough student in school, getting into trouble.
Meet your sister.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and I, again, really helpful stuff for my own work in, you know, education and developing courses for teaching teachers how to think about difficult children, because I was a bit difficult myself. No, I was good fun and all the rest of it, but, you know, I could definitely push it a bit far and get myself in trouble at school. And, you know, teachers were kind of, I suppose, pulling their hair out, kind of going, what are we going to do with this fella? Because my brother ahead of me 2 years was super. He was just this incredible academic guy. He was just a genius. And
oh my God, that sounds like my family. My brother was the same. He was head boy. He was the prefect. He was academically just unbelievable. And I was, you know, average Joe, and really happiest when I was pushing boundaries, yeah. And like had that. It was, I just always wanted a sense of freedom. I didn't like rules. I didn't like, and again, sort of my dad, you know, I'm quite like him in that way, in that he was a little bit like that himself. He later admitted, you know, when he could admit it when we were all kind of out of our early teens. And it was just, I just wanted freedom. I wanted go, and that, like, anything that sort of, I was out and about experiencing something new and exciting made me innately happy.
Exactly. And so, connecting with people, that was really what I loved, connecting with people. But I also had dyslexia as a kid, and it was undiagnosed for many years. And I was good at English, but couldn't understand how I couldn't get what was in my head down on the paper. I just thought I was stupid. And, you know, in the 80s, going through education, you got that given to you. I mean, teachers did tell you were stupid, and you certainly felt it, until I met one teacher in fifth class, Miss O'Grady. And I wrote about her in the Examiner, and she wrote me a letter afterwards. I wrote about the importance of meeting someone like her. And it was just a beautiful moment. I was in my clinic, and she sent me an email, and I was just like in floods of tears, sitting there going, my God, all of this stuff came up for me. All of the stuff of, like, you know, feeling stupid, feeling, trying to hide yourself, trying to feel, you know, trying to guard yourself. And a lot of my misbehavior, let's say, was as a way to deflect the fact that I was finding, you know, spellings and maths very difficult. And my other brothers were just these, you know, incredibly academic and were flying off ahead of me. And I just so struggled for a period until I got to college. And then I was just like, oh my God, when I got a laptop, I was like, Jesus, this is unbelievable.
Amazing.
It was just like, you know, amazing. The English department wrote to me, asked me, would I keep English on? I was like, what the hell? I'm getting feedback here that I'm pretty good. you know, education in primary school was like, you're pretty bad. And it was very difficult. And it really changed. It really made me think and talk about myself in a very negative way. And it was again in my 20s where I kind of really worked this stuff out and really kind of, you know, started to redefine who I thought I was.
So why do you believe that you were able to come out of quite a difficult childhood and make the decision to not go down the same path, to kind of have a more positive, happy existence and bring happiness to the people that you love, whether it was your friends or your family or your colleagues or whatever? And some kids don't ever, you know, cross over to that and follow the path of unhappiness or self-destruction or...
Yeah, no, it's a very good question, Catherine. And, you know, I did a 4-year master's with the Mater Hospital in UCD. It's called Systemic Family Psychotherapy. And before I started that course, which gave me great insights, you can't do a course like, you know, psychotherapy without really analyzing who you are. Why do you want to do the things that you do? Why do you do the things you do? What's your behavior all about and your relationship with your wife? And, you know, you can't do a course without really unpacking all that stuff. But even before that, I must say, very early on, I remember thinking this in even primary school, that I wanted to help other people who felt the way I felt. You know, I really wanted to help people, because I remember when I'm around 15, I wasn't feeling so great and I was getting a lot of trouble. My mother brought me to a psychiatrist and she said to me before I was going in, you know, make sure you don't tell him about dad. He knows dad. Don't tell him anything about dad. And before I went in, I was straitjacketed. You know, I couldn't say, you know, my family system here is a bit chaotic and that's the reason I'm feeling pretty crap. It's not because there's something internal inside me that's, you know, really, really awful. It's just that my environment is pretty difficult to navigate and there's a lot of uncertainty and there's a lot of, like, you know, really difficult moments in this family. And I really wanted to speak to that kid who felt that straitjacketed, that kid who felt, you know, silenced, that kid who felt he didn't have a voice. I really felt in those moments were where I took a photograph and went, all right, that's something I want to fix that. If anyone comes across my life that has this in their lives, I want to be able to give them some advice and I want to give them some help in it. And so I started off my career, actually, Catherine, as an English teacher. And students used to always come up to me talking to me about their lives. And I was kind of going, what is it? My wife would be saying, you know, kids just relate to you. And I think she thought it because I was probably down at their level. Emotionally, maybe. And she said, you know, they really relate to you and, you know, they really see something in you. And then the principals that I was working at school were saying, the kids really, like, you know, they really open up to you. There's something there. Why don't you think about it? And I was thinking, you know, this might be something, because I started off my degree with psychology and English. And then I thought, okay, maybe I could find some language for what I'm doing here with the kids. Maybe I could find some techniques. And that's why I retrained and went back into systemic family psychotherapy. And it was family psychotherapy that I went for because of my own background.
Gotcha.
And, you know, to understand the ecology. Because I never think that a problem exists. You know, psychodynamics and all that might think about the problem being in Catherine Thomas. It mightn't think about the system that you're living in. And the systems that we navigate are so complicated and they impact on us so much. To not think about those, I think, is an error in our approach to psychology. And so systemics is all about systems and the systems that you're living in. And that's what I really, when I started that course, I was like, oh my God, this is just like kind of like arriving home almost, you know, because the first thing you do is, the first thing you do is a genogram where you lay out your family tree and you look at the impact that your family has had to bring you to this moment. And it was just an incredibly cathartic kind of experience.
Amazing. Let's talk about family for a little bit, because when we were having a chat before last week when you agreed to do the chat, which I was so thankful for, you mentioned the unhappy years, which I had never heard of before. So this is, according to research carried out by the US National Bureau of Economic Research, found that people in their 50s are happier than those in their 40s, and those in their 60s are happier still.
Yeah.
So kind of mid to late 40s are, from a research perspective, labeled the unhappy years. So I'm 42 now. And as I said, feeling pretty okay. Yeah, meaning of life. Feeling pretty okay, but... what is going to happen in the next couple of years that's going to knock me off my perch?
Well, I think, I suppose the reason I wrote that article and talked about that is that I think that there's so many traps in your 40s that you can fall into. And I think people don't think about what they are. And I suppose when I was thinking about this interview, a thought that kept coming into my mind as I was watching the Friends reunion. I don't know, did you see that?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, the Friends reunion. Brilliant. We were of the age where, like, you know, we were like, Friends was just happening as I was a teenager and all that. And so it was just a part of the zeitgeist. And it was just this, it was like the Beatles. It was this massive social.
Massive.
It was just, yeah. It's hard to explain to other kids that a TV show could be a part of, like, you know, how you speak and how you do. And everybody was just copying the phrases and Rachel and Ross. Everything was just a part of, like, you know, our lives. And I was just thinking about that. When the show ends, they're just about late 30s, early 40s, right? And that's kind of what happens in our lives. You know, all that friendship ends there. You know, that you know that they're moving off into their married lives and they're moving off into something else. They're not going to be a social support group for each other anymore. And that's what happens in your 40s, I think. And I think you have to be very intentional about it, that you have to be careful that your friends don't disappear, because, you know, when you have a child and when you have children and your career is going and you've aspirations, and when you're in your 20s and 30s, early 30s, you have all these aspirations. In your 40s, perhaps you feel like you haven't reached the aspirations, and you might feel like as you're moving towards your mid 40s, like 47.2 is when they say you're most unhappy, is that perhaps you feel that it's passed you by. You won't get where you want to go now. You're nearing towards 50. You know, the idea of 50. Scary 50. I'm 45 now, so I'm moving towards it and I can feel it coming. And, you know, this the idea of relevance and will I be as relevant? And it's something I think about my work with teenagers. Will I be in touch with teenagers like I was, and like kind of maybe like I am when I'm 50 or even, you know, 55? Will they be looking at me as a dinosaur and kind of going, this guy, how can this guy know anything about, you know, what's going on in the teenage world? And these kind of thoughts kind of creep in. But more importantly, I think the huge thing is that we lose connection with our friends. They're not as important, or not that they're not important as important, but we develop our own little, you know, our own little unit, our own little family that becomes our network. And we probably don't see our friends as much as we'd like to. And all that stuff at work, and probably feeling unfulfilled in our work and maybe lacking a little bit of meaning in the work that we do. And then also feeling that perhaps there's no way of changing now. I have to stay with this because of the financial responsibilities and because I brought children into the world. I can't take a risk now anymore. And so you feel really kind of stuck. And that's what I would say, you know, that's what people towards their mid to late 40s can feel, really a sense of kind of like, you know, nowhere out here. I can't do anything here. I'm stuck in this situation that I'm in.
And I've seen it. I've seen it with friends of mine. I mean, I you know, we're late to the table. Pork. My husband is 52. I'm 42. We have a 3-year-old. So a lot of my kids, a lot of my friends had kids, seven, eight, 9 years ago. And the majority of them, like, brilliant and happily married. But for a few, you know, it's kind of, they got to that stage, and I never really understood it, but now as a parent I do, because I'm looking at Ellie 3 years, I'm like, where in the name of Jesus did that go? And so you're the first year you're on the roller coaster, and who am I? Like, yeah. Who am I
without
who
Ellie? Who am I? Yeah,
who is the girl? Where is the girl who used to travel around the world, put a bag on her back, and be in second Papua New Guinea one day, and, you know, drinking cocktails the next, and climbing mountains, and so you do feel a slight sense of loss. Sometimes I'd be lying there and going, God, life is so different, and what's changed in 3 or 4 years, you know. And, you know, we're happily married, and I'm so thankful, and I've got a lovely home, and all of those things, and I've got a great job that I love. But I do catch myself going. And I think especially in the last 14 months as well, when we haven't seen our friends, and I've figured out very early on who are the people who I pick up the phone to all the time, and who are the people that I have to think about picking up the phone to, and who are the people that I don't want to see the name coming up because I know they depress the life out of me. Do you know what I mean? So I think this year, this 14 months has been very, from a friend's perspective and from a personal perspective, when we're actually just focusing on our own happiness, it's been an eye opener. And I think it's been enlightening for a lot of people, but I think it's also been, it's been cathartic for a lot of people. But I think for a lot of people, it's thrown up problems that maybe were brushed under the carpet or not even being faced. You know, it's like, I'm so busy with work, I'm so busy with school runs and shopping, and I'm not dealing with the shit in my relationship. I'm not dealing with the fact that I'm unhappy at work. And so I'm assuming that you have people coming into your clinic who literally go, how did I end up here?
Absolutely. I think so much has come up over the last 15 months. I think it's really illuminated and elucidated an awful lot for us. And like you said, maybe stuff that we were just like, you know, living with and kind of like not so happy living with. And I think a huge thing is that what I would have seen over the last 14 to 15 months was the pressure put on women. That was an incredible thing over the last 15 months. I think it really illuminated the inequity that can exist in families and probably an unspoken inequity that exists in society, and that that a woman can take on the burden of, you know, the can take on everything and become. And again, underneath that is a paradigm that's very negative and destructive, like the good daughter and the good wife and doing everything, you know, and the parent. And at our age, I suppose another reason why we might be unhappy is that our parents are aging and they're moving off maybe into their 70s or 80s. And you know that you're that now the mother is looking after those their parents as well as trying to run the family and trying to work and trying to maintain contact with her. I mean, the pressure over the last 14 to 15 months on women, I think, was just I saw it so much in my clinic, Catherine, and it all came out of that kind of paradigm. And the question I'd ask them is, I'd say to them, say if we're talking, I'd say, but where's Catherine in all of this? Like, you know, where's Catherine? And they'd stop. They'd be like, I know, Richard. This is I've lost myself. I know I've lost myself. And I'd say, well, what do you think is driving? What's forcing you to keep going in this? What's the belief you have? And she said, well, it's my duty. You know, I have to do this. I, you know, this the good daughter. I mean, I have to be the good daughter. And it's a very destructive paradigm. And I think, it creates incredible sense of unhappiness. Another thing I think that can creep in as well.
And you know what? And we're devils for it as well, women, because, you know, we feel too guilty to step back a lot of the time. And yeah. I'm a devil for it as well. It's like, in one way, it's my own fault and I can see it a lot of the time because I'm maybe a bit of a control freak, but it's like, I'll do it. I step up and say, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're wondering why on Friday you feel like, you know, you've been run over by a bus, you know.
It's unsustainable. And no. What I'd always say to what I particularly women, I'd say, like, you know, a people pleaser pleases no one, but least of all themselves. Mm-hmm. And eventually they come to resent the people that are they're trying to please, and they begin to resent themselves because they realize they've been positioned like this. And so it breeds nothing but, you know, discontent. And so, you know, it's not selfish. And I write about this so all the time. It's so important to say no, I won't do that. No, I can't do that today. I can't do this. It's so important to develop that into your lexicon to say, no, that's not, you know, that's not for me. I can't do that, because you just burn out and you become just a kind of like a shadow of yourself. And nobody wants to exist like that. You have to thrive through these years. I mean, these 40 years are where you're healthy, hopefully, and you've got more money than you had before, and your children are growing up. And these are the years that you're going to reflect on when you're, you know, when you move off from your career and you're looking back in your life. These are the moments that you're going to look back on with fondness. So let's make them real. Let's make that fondness, when you look back, something that you actually felt rather than nostalgia, something that you kind of made up, and that, you know, that you actually thrived through these years. So that it's about looking at the traps that you can fall into.
And that's the one thing I was going to ask you is, should we be focusing on what makes us unhappy to figure out what's going to make us happy?
Well, it's a very important thing. If you're not looking at the empirical evidence of your life, Catherine, you're a prisoner to your behavior. If you're not looking at what makes you happy or unhappy and avoiding it like something that doesn't make you happy, right? I mean, you'll fall into it. And so I'd often say to clients, you know, what don't you like? You know, what is it that when you really feel crap, what's happened? And they'd say, well, I caught myself being weak in work. I said something I didn't want to say, or I caught myself gossiping, or, you know, I don't like when I shout at the kids, or, okay, let's have a look at that. I don't like when I compare myself. I don't like the way I look at my brother's life and think his life was way better than mine. Or I don't like the way my sister always makes me feel, blah, blah, blah. So you look at the things that don't make, that really generally make you unhappy. And I'd say, okay, let's look at that. And then you change it and you say, right, you're going to introduce change in here and you're going to avoid that stuff, right? Avoid the stuff that makes you unhappy. So that's the empirical evidence. That's the physical evidence. You know how you feel when you say something, when you shout at the kids, or when you find yourself comparing. That stuff makes you unhappy. And it's funny, actually, because I always say to my kids, because I'm always talking about this stuff when I'm walking to school, and I say to them, you know, comparison is the thief of joy, guys. Don't compare yourself to, you know,
absolutely,
anybody. You know, it's
absolutely
the thief of joy. It's very funny, though. My daughter now is 7, and about 2 weeks ago, we were driving down to Malahide, and I was coming up through Old Street, whatever, and I saw these beautiful houses, and I said, Jesus, this beautiful house there. And my 7-year-old pops up from the back, goes, Dad, comparison is the thief of joy.
I love, I
like,
her.
You got me. Yeah, you got me. I was her. Like, you're dead right. You're dead right.
But do you worry? And it's one thing. Sorry for interrupting you.
No, you're fine.
Because now with the age of social media, where comparison, kids are just literally their happiness is draining out of their faces as they're sitting there doing this and being bombarded by where they think their happiness should lie. And I just, I'm really concerned as to where it's all going to be in when Ellie is 13 in 10 years' time. God, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, it scares the shit out of me.
No, it scares me too, Catherine. And I've got a 10-year-old. Thankfully, she's never asked me for a phone because she knows it's not going to happen for a long time. I have a 7-year-old who would probably
What age limit? What age are you going to give her a phone?
You see, the thing, I wrote the book Parenting the Screenager, and I carried out huge research on it, right? I went around to 25 schools and spoke to hundreds of students and carried out a huge piece of little data there to help me write the book. And a lot of it was around technology, obviously, because Parenting the Screenager and the impact technology was having on kids and their social interactions and their communication. I was talking to kids up in Dundalk and they're as young as 7 and they're all over smartphones and they weren't going to school and they weren't sleeping and they're, you know, they were school refusing and all that kind of stuff. So a smartphone, you have to be really careful when you give a smartphone to your child. And parents ask me this all the time in the clinic, you know, what age would you give it to your child? And I'd say to them, well, it really depends on the child. But as a rule of thumb, my child won't be getting a smartphone till they're in secondary school. And then depending on what kind of way they, you know, how mature they are, and are they responsible enough to take all what a smartphone brings into their life? You know, Catherine, the amount of kids that I meet also who are, you know, using pornography, and we can look all over the media and see the the Anna Kriegel case where Boy A was consuming incredibly, really explicit bestiality and really terrible stuff that a kid of that age should not be experiencing. And once you have a smartphone into your hand, unfortunately, and I actually spoke to Micheál Martin about this actually before in October about pornography, and I was saying to them, this is a really destructive thing for kids. We have to really step up here. We can't let these platforms exist without having some sort of check. And he agreed, but he also said it's a very rapidly evolving landscape and it's very hard to policy it, but they're trying their best to come up with something. And I was just saying to him, like, just at least for a 10-year-old, if you had to put your email into consume the pornography, that would stop them because they think they're going to be watched.
They're going to get caught, yeah.
They're going to get caught. So that would stop them. When I was a kid, to consume pornography, I had to walk into my local village in Cork and say, how are you, Seamus? Can I get the Hustler? You'd never in their life even think about it. You know, it's wasn't in your mind at all. And so now with smartphones, you know, I mean, it's such an important thing to think about. What age do you want your children to be engaged in them? And then on these, you know, these real superficial platforms like Snapchat, and it's all about, you know, selfies, and, you know, they're developing ideas about self, and the amount of children I talk to about body image and, you know, food issues. And they're very, very difficult things to work at as a psychotherapist to crack something like anorexia because, you know, they come out of this idea. They generally begin with, like, you know, being healthy, and they generally begin with wanting to look better, and then they pathologize into, like, you know, not eating, controlling food.
And they are also looking at us with our smartphones.
Oh, absolutely.
In the evenings, sitting down, putting up selfies with filters. I've actually stopped using filters about 4 weeks ago, because I saw, it's actually a friend of mine, Sheila Shoiga, put up a really strong post, and she was very visibly upset in it. And there was a Dove ad about how the impact of how how girls as young as, and research all points to girls as young as 6-7 years of age having real problems with body dysmorphia filtering. And it was just started off with this face that you didn't recognize, it was so filtered, and then it just cut back, and it just went back until you just saw this beautiful, innocent little 7-year-old, you know, looking absolutely gorgeous and natural, you know. And I just went, I have to take responsibility here. Why am I sticking a filter on, you know? And I think
it's a very good conversation, because it's such an important thing to think about. And boys are being impacted by it. Traditionally, it was always girls who had to suffer with this stuff, but boys recently, in the last number of years, and steroid use has gone up massively, and all this idea of, like, you know, Love Island, I think it's called, where they have these buff guys and these really thin girls. And a huge thing I'd say to parents is something I really, really think about, because I've got 3 daughters, how you talk about people on TV. It's such an important thing. Think about my wife. I remember my wife pointed out to me, first of all, she's like, we have to be so careful that we don't talk negatively about anybody, you know, that you'd see. Because it's so easy to creep and go, God, Jesus, look at the size of her, and whatever. And all of a sudden your child is then turning this, internalizing this prejudice, and internalizing this awful talk about weight and how someone looks, and then they speak to themselves the same way, and they say, well, if I'm going to put on a bit of weight, that's what they'll say about me, and so I won't. And all of a sudden then we create this terrible, you know, dynamic that you have to be a certain way. You have to, you know, food then becomes thought about just about calories and, you know, about watching it. It's so destructive, Catherine, and it's really important that we work. I think, you know, what you're saying about Sheila Shoga, it's really important that people like yourself as well, that you talk about this kind of stuff, because, you know, you might be considered glamorous and attractive, and it's really important that girls get this message from people that they look up to. You know, it's like Shakespeare says, and yet by heaven, I think my love is as rare as any belied by false compare. And it's the idea of false compare that's filters. You're more beautiful for your blemishes. You're more beautiful because of who you are and the uniqueness of who you are. And kids need to get that message.
And we see it down on our retreats all the time. We have women that come, and I do a workshop where I say, you know, they come down, they think they're going to be the slowest, the most unfit, the fattest, you know, the odd one out, and they're worried about what everybody thinks of them, you know. And my mission with Pure Results and with my team is to really get people to understand that and what they're capable of, and that their bodies, and they're capable of so much more, and we are capable of so much more than we give ourselves credit for.
Absolutely.
And but even trying to do a workshop where you're going, you know, what are you proud of yourself? What are you proud of this week? What did what have you achieved this week that you didn't think you were going to be able to? I mean, I've had women come down and they go, now, Catherine, get out of the Nissan Micra, whatever. I'm not running. I've had 4 children. I don't run, whatever. And by day 3, they're running. Because it's, you know, you just go from one lamppost to the next, or you, and it's just this kind of voice, as you said at the beginning of this conversation, that we tell each other, we tell ourselves stuff that we can't do. And then it just becomes, you know, that wheel that goes around all the time. But it's like, I'd often say, can you say that you love yourself, or what part of yourself do you love? And very few people can find anything to say. And I think I've worked really hard on being able to say that I do love myself, and you know, done a lot of kind of listening to people, and I think it stems from, again, it's that sort of real Irish thing that, you know, if you say you love yourself, you're up your own arse. Kind of school playground. You've notions, that one is notions. But I think it's so important, and I think it's a real lesson for our children that we do get to some point where we can accept and acknowledge that we are great people, and we're great humans, you know. And I think that's such an important message that people don't think about. So going back, I suppose, to what, you know, if we do want to get to a happier place within ourselves, what are the simple steps? And I know it's not brush strokes for all, but what are the simple, if somebody is listening to this right now and they are not in a good place and they are not happy, what are the kind of the simple steps to look at in terms of maybe trying to refocus those thought processes?
Yeah, I think, you know, any psychiatrist around the world will tell you that the first thing for any mild mental health condition here, you know, you're feeling really low and you're feeling lethargic, and you're talking to yourself in a very negative way, and you don't have motivation, and you might be, your lifestyle might be a little bit inert, and you're not moving so much. The first thing I would always say, and this is why, you know, something like Operation Transformation and what you've been doing is so important. The first thing you should always do is look at your diet and look at your exercise routine. Sleep is a huge thing that has a deleterious impact on our mental health. You know, the fact that when we're sleep deprived, it really makes us vulnerable for the next day, and makes us more susceptible to negative thoughts, and makes us more susceptible to eating unhealthily, and makes us more susceptible to not exercising, and then getting caught in a pattern of very negative behaviors. So the first thing I would always say, and I was giving a lot of talks in schools over the last 15 months to students, and I'd say to them, how are things going? And they'd say, oh, not so great, Richard, pretty crap. And I'd say, okay, tell me what you're doing. And they'd say, well, I'm just flicking up the laptop, staying in bed, staying supine in bed, and, you know, staying there all day, getting up, then going downstairs, and then going on my phone, and then I'm eating something, then coming back and going to bed. And like, but yeah, okay, so how's that going for you? And they're like, oh, it's really bad. I say, okay, so you have to introduce change here to see if you can modify this a little bit. So I'd say to them, like, I'd give them a little bit of exercise. I'd say, get up in the morning before school, go for a walk, go for a jog, go for a light jog, or go for a jog, depending where you're at. Come back, have a shower, take your laptop, separate it from where you're sleeping. Don't be, you know, on your laptop in your sleep in your bedroom. Try to find another space if you have it in the house where you can go on your laptop and go on your classes. And then when you're finished that, have your lunch and go out for a walk again. And then I'd say to them, I'd come back to them at the end of that for about 2 weeks and say, well, how are things now? And then you could see it on them. You could just see the dramatic improvement in their mental health because they were getting out, they were getting into the sun, they were getting, you know, a space. A huge thing that we always need is a bit of space. I don't know if you felt this, Catherine, but I definitely did over the last 15 months that you were incredibly on top of, well, I was felt incredibly like, you know, on top of your children. You were all together and my wife, and we were just all so, you know, bound together, that it's really important. I'd say to my wife, look, get out there for 40 minutes, go for a walk, go down to the village, get a coffee. And she'd say the same to me. So I'd go for a cycle, go for a swim or whatever. So you get separation. And it's really important that you get that separation from your house, that you can be Catherine Thomas, you can be Richard Hogan, because I have an identity separate from my wife and I have an identity separate from my children. But, you know, in the last 15 months, it was kind of all kind of one. And so it's really important that you're intentional about that and that you do reconnect with yourself. And so I would go for a cycle on my own and go down to Low Rock here in Malahide and go for a swim. And I'd be there for half an hour and cycle back. And you're just like a different person. So you, again, it's about really.
And I think the difference there is, and am I being really generalistic by saying that? Men can do that and go, like my husband goes for his run, goes for whatever. Whereas I feel, and I have to stop myself, go, when, like my me time, when I have to get my me time, I kind of feel not guilty, well, guilty about it sometimes, but also, have I got this done? Have I got that done before I get out for my run? Before I go and meet my friend for a walk in the Phoenix Park? You know what I mean? And that has to stop.
That has to stop. Stupid. And that's that. Good wife or good daughter, or there's a paradigm in there about, you know, if I don't have that done, the whole thing will fall apart. Well, if you don't have it done, it's not done. Nothing's going to change here. Everything is fixable. And if you don't get the washing on or whatever it is you're thinking, or get the email sent or, you know, respond to that phone call or whatever it is that you're thinking about, it's like, okay, you're going to go for a cycle or go for a run, whatever it is, get out and go for your run and free your mind from the house and free your mind from whatever you feel the tasks are that you feel that you need to be doing. It's really important that you break that little thought about, like, you know, if I don't get this done, I have to do this and this and this. So by the time you're going out, you're wound up. You know, it's really important that you just get out and go for a cycle or get out and get separate from. I'd even leave my device when I go for a cycle like that down for a swim. I'd leave my device behind me. So I'm absolutely just, you know, enjoying the environment and enjoying my surroundings and being kind of like, you know, there at the beach for a second and separate from all the family and separate from all the responsibilities and separate from all the work that you're doing. And you're just a dude having a swim. And that's really important, you know, and that's really important. You know, we're talking about what makes us happy and what can help us to get happier is to be intentional. I think happiness is an intentionality. You have to think about, what do I need to bring into my life? I think people can expect it to happen and expect it to be just there. And why am I not happy? But you actually have to go out and pursue it and do things and be intentional about those things. And then start making a little journal about, yeah, I actually felt really good that day. I went for the cycling, went for the swim. I'm going to start doing more of that. Developing a little bit of gratitude as well. It's very important. You know, what are you grateful for in your life? It's really important.
And also, if people find themselves, as you say, stuck in a rut, you know, and it's like you're afraid to, and I think that's a big thing for a lot of clients that we would see down in on our retreats. It's like feeling that you're on the hamster wheel and not having the courage to jump off, or, you know, I've always wanted to learn to cycle, or I've always wanted to, everyone sees swimming now, why am I not sea swimming or learn the guitar? And I mean, where I suppose there's a fine line between knowing that you need to do something different, but actually figuring out what it is that you want, as opposed to looking at your brother who is the fabulous house, who's great at sea swimming, and all of a sudden you think that that's going to make you happy. So I love the fact that you're saying it has to be intentional, but you really need to focus on what it is that's going to make you happy, and what you think is going to make you happy.
Exactly, and not what you think makes other people happy, so that's going to make
me
happy.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what we often get caught in. We can often get caught in, well, that seems to make him happy, I'm going to do that now. You have to think about what, you know, what is it that you want to do? What is it that actually brings moments of levity into your life and brings you, you know, peace and brings you a little bit of harmony in your life? Just, again, it's really about being aware of that stuff and looking at what, you know, empirically, what is it that makes me kind of feel kind of good about myself? And I honestly think doing a little bit of altruism also makes us very happy. You know, when we help other people and we do things that are not just for us, I think that brings a lot of happiness into our own lives as well. And that's something that I think people should always look at, about how do I help the community, or what can I do in the community that can bring a little bit of something to the community that brings us joy ourselves and a sense of kind of meaning for ourselves and our community.
So would you be an advocate of simple, small changes and like maybe, as you said, taking a journal, looking at mapping out the next month and, you know, implementing one or two changes in your week and using it as an experiment. But as you said, we've got to be intentional about it. If we're not in a good place, we've really got to sit down and ask the hard questions and figure out why and sit with ourselves.
Absolutely. We all get caught into a little balance, like a homeostasis, where we all get caught into a way of being. And at times it can be quite destructive. And at times we can adopt maladaptive behaviors, negative things that, you know, don't bring us happiness. And again, it's about really looking at the stuff that we're doing that's not making us happy and then changing that. And as you said there, so I think it's very important, is about having a little journal and seeing, you know, I went for a cycle today, how did I feel afterwards? Actually, what you're doing there is you're actually looking at the evidence of your life. And you're thinking about what's actually making me feel better. And that's what happens a lot of the times. People aren't aware of themselves and they're not aware of what makes them happy and what makes them unhappy. So then they're kind of like a prisoner to their behavior. They don't know, you know, what should I do here? And so sitting down with a journal at the end of the week and thinking, well, when I went for a cycle Monday, I felt really good. When I went for a walk, when I met my friends, let's say, you know, meeting your friends is such an important part, the feedback that you gain for your friends. There's a group in Okinawa in Japan called the Moai, right? They're a social little group that's intentionally set up from a young age. And it's about supporting each other financially, emotionally, spiritually. It's a little group that they set up, and they, you know, the study on it is incredible, that they're the happiest, they live the longest. And this is a group set up from childhood, and it goes with them all the way through their lives. And I think we need to do that ourselves, because I think what happens in our 40s is that we lose that little like friends reunion. You lose those friends because you move off into your life, and you move off into your married life, and, you know, married life, and you've got children. It can become almost like you're two workers tapping each other on that, you know, and you're in now and I'm out, and you're subbing in and subbing out. And
which is why, when a marriage breaks down, or if you find yourself in a relationship where you know that it's not working and yet there's a fear that's holding you there, because the thoughts of actually trying to start again or untangle where, you know, and I think, you know, if whether that's an unhappiness in your career or your job or your relationship or your home setup, and walking away from that, you know, when you've already possibly felt that you've lost a lot of friends, or you're at a stage where it has literally just become you guys in your house, for example.
Exactly.
Walking away, like, the fear holds people back for years.
Absolutely. And what they perceive to be the complete annihilation of their social circle, you know, and you'd hear people saying, well, people don't go around in singles, they go around in couples, and, you know, all these kind of things hold people back from actually making a leap that might bring them to something of fulfillment in their own lives. And you're dead right. It's that fear of the unknown. It's the familiar, say, dysfunction, or the familiar unhappiness that they stay in, because what's ahead is unknowable and unknown. And so they stay in the familiar, and it brings just an incredible amount of unhappiness and sadness and melancholy into their lives. And it does take a little leap of courage, and it is a very difficult thing to do. And I work a lot with families that have separated, and a lot of parents probably think that, you know, if I separate, it's going to damage the kids. But the research would show you it's not about separation. It's about how you behave in the pre and post separation landscape that really damages the kids. It's not actually the separation itself. And I work a lot with kids, and especially in functioning families, let's say, where the separation has occurred. And they'd say to me, oh, no, it's way better. It's much better. I get to see dad, and he's much more himself, and mom's much more herself. And, you know, we're all working together, and it's going very well. And then, of course, when it's destructive and it's, you know, there's alienation and there's all very negative things, it's, you know, a very, very difficult situation.
Very different situation. Yeah. I have so enjoyed that chat. Thank you so
Absolutely,
much for
Catherine.
Your time. I've kept you longer than I said I
no
would.
Worries. No worries.
But I suppose the take homes that I've got from today is that, in, you know, comparison, you know, we actually have to move away. Yeah. Big time. And also being very intentional about what makes us happy, and understanding that it actually takes a little bit of work. You know, even for me at the beginning of this conversation, I said I'm somebody who's got a naturally sort of happy disposition. But when I now know, I suppose, when I'm having a bad week or a bad month, it's actually looking at it and sitting down and going, okay,
what was it about that?
What was it? Yeah. And I can't be, you know, it's kind of crazy to think that you can be in a happy place all the time.
No, you can't.
you're ridiculous.
You'd never enjoy Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen or watch Shakespeare.
Exactly. Well, listen, thank you so much. And I now know, the one other thing what I was thinking about when we were chatting there, because I suppose, say in my situation, and a lot of women and families, we're having families later. Does that mean I have to be mindful of the unhappy years in my early 50s?
Well, it's a good point. Where I think what happens here, what makes people unhappy, especially women, is that they feel guilty because they think that they're older and that they haven't got the same energy their parents had because when they were younger and raised their children, and also that they have to work hard, they have to work to meet the financial demands of the modern world, that they can feel really guilty. And so that guilt feeds into how they parent their children, and then they might be a little bit more lenient with their children and acquiesce more and give into the kids and then develop expectancies within the child. And you get into a lot of conflict with your child when they become, you know, and they expect everything to be their way, and they find it very hard to compromise. And so I think mothers can really find that makes a lot of unhappiness in their lives. And you're saying, should it be in their 50s? Well, no, I don't think it's just about children. The study was about, you know, it didn't just take mothers, let's say, and fathers into account. It was just at a particular arc of life, and 47.2 was the age to watch out for. And I just think it's down to what we're talking about friends, losing connection with people, the pressures of life, the relational life, you know, the sense of familiarity that we have with our partner, the lack of spontaneity, all the things that we lose out on as we age.
I think if we're aware of all of those pitfalls, we know.
Absolutely. We won't fall into it, yeah.
Exactly. Richard Hogan, thank you so much for your time today.
Great to see you, Catherine. Thanks so much.
Great to see you. Thanks so much. Bye.